The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
The Institute of Art and Ideas, articles, videos, and podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, the podcast that brings you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. Why do people trust some experts, but not others? And how can we improve trust between the public and experts? On today's episode, we're exploring the philosophical relationship between trust and relativism. To help us, we're joined by one of the world's leading experts on moral and epistemological relativism, Professor of American Philosophy at University College Dublin, Maria Bagramian.
The issue of disagreement about science or disagreement among experts actually boils down to the question of trust in experts. Which of these disagreeing sides do you trust?
If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review, join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, and head over to our website, iai.tv. Back now to Maria Bagramian. So Maria, is there a philosophical link between your work on relativism and your work on trust?
Surprisingly enough, I suppose there is. My philosophical interests and throughout my life and a long career have centered on the question of disagreement and difference. If you wanted to find a sociological or personal reason for that, it goes back to my history as someone belonging to a multiplicity of cultures and languages and political systems. And I have always perceived these differences and disagreements in the background of my life and have wanted to find philosophical as well as personal answers to the difficult questions that they raise. So let's take relativism first. One of the main motivations for relativism going back to Protagoras was the fact that there are so many disagreements among people. People disagree, using the examples that Protagoras gave. People disagree about whether the wind is cold or hot. That's the simplest of disagreements. But people disagree about politics. They disagree about ethics. They disagree about what is there out there in the world, etc., etc. And some of these disagreements are intractable. They cannot be resolved. How are we going to respond to these intractable disagreements? Well, relativism is one response. There are disagreements, we all know that, so you can either say that only one side is right, or you can say that both sides of the disagreements are right, one according to his or her cultural and sociological and framework and background, and the next according to his or her own very different cultural or social or cognitive framework. So that solves in some ways the problem of disagreement. Now, how does that relate to trust? Okay, so when I was thinking about disagreement in this wider context, with the start of political upheavals in Western democracies, with Brexit and Trump, etc., etc., the question of disagreement among scientists, peer disagreement, something that as a philosopher I was familiar with, started to have a very direct influence on our lives and our own choices and on public discourse in general. So I started looking at that particular issue through a research project called When Experts Disagree. The project was, well, multidisciplinary between a scientist and a philosopher, but had a practical dimension. We just wanted to see how we can understand the phenomenon of disagreement among scientists. And then more or less all hell broke loose, and we had series of backlashes against experts, whether it was on climate science or against economists, etc. And I began looking into the question in much more detail and in a more practical sense, in a sense that was relevant to empirical work being done in these areas. And at that stage, I realized that the issue of disagreement about science or disagreement among experts actually boils down to question of trust in experts. Which of these disagreeing sides do you trust? Hence, my work with relativism ended me in work in on trust.
So why do people trust some experts but not others?
The project When Experts Disagree was fundamentally just about that, about instances of disagreement between experts with similar background and similar training and similar understanding of issues, and yet coming up with very different conclusions. We were particularly interested at that time in the question of climate science, but in fact, the series of studies that we did showed that supported the view that there is relatively little disagreement among climate scientists. Our other case study was disagreement among astrophysicists. They found out that there was far greater disagreement among astrophysicists than climate scientists, but astrophysics does not have any political consequences, so no one pays much attention to their work. But then gradually, as I said, this study culminated in the question of trust in science. And currently, I'm running a large European Commission project called PERITIA, or Policy Expertise and Trust in Action, a multidisciplinary project with 11 participating countries, where we are focusing on the markers for trust in experts, the public opinion on trust in experts, and also steps to take to establish trustworthy relationships between the public, policymakers, and the experts. So what we think now, what we are focusing now, is not just question of trust, but we have turned it into the question of trustworthiness. We should not blindly trust anyone. So that applies to all areas. We should only trust those who are trustworthy. So the question we are asking, what are the markers? What are the conditions? What are the criteria of trustworthiness? And not just how and when we trust others, including experts. So there are some standard, well-known criteria for trustworthiness: efficiency, reliability, honesty, etc., etc. And those criteria are established on basis of track record, background education, performance, and so on. But also, we think that looking at the political scene today, many experts and policymakers may have underestimated the role of, firstly, emotions or affects, and secondly, role of values in establishing trust and trustworthiness. Various studies, including those done by one of my colleagues in the project, Bobby Duffy at King's College London, have shown that people actually perceive trustworthiness in terms of not just these formal criteria of competence and track record, etc., but also in terms of group values and group emotions. Trust involves a feeling, a sense of vulnerability. When you trust someone, you're taking a risk. You make yourself open to betrayal. Trust always is accompanied by the possibility of betrayal. And it's that possibility that should be taken account in the relationships between people who are to be trusted or wish to be trusted and people who do the trusting. And I think, maybe somewhat controversially, that this applies to experts just as much to our parents and friends and children, etc.
Why is that controversial?
Well, some people think that we can't talk about trust in experts. As Susan Howey, excellent philosopher working on trust in Edinburgh, thinks that we should just rely on, talk about reliance on experts as groups rather than individuals. They think that, that experts or trust is a question of a relationship between individuals rather than groups. When it comes to experts, the way expertise works, at least in policymaking conditions, it's groups of experts that give policy advice. You see that in under current circumstances of COVID-19. And the question is, can we really talk about trusting groups, or should we only talk about trusting the individuals within groups? Also, in various psychological and political studies of expertise, there has been very little attention to the question of affect or emotions and the question of values. Up to now, we have been doing quite a wide-ranging survey of these views, and we don't find much discussion of these affective and normative or evaluative considerations in approaches to trust by political scientists and even at times psychologists. So it's controversial in that sense as well, that not many people have done it.
So how do you think trust can be improved between the public and experts?
So our project has three steps. The first step, and that's the step we are currently engaged in, is purely theoretical. We are looking at philosophical, sociological, and psychological literature on trust in experts. The second phase is empirical. And that's going to start quite soon. We are going to do surveys in novel ways, in ways that have not been done before, to at least to some extent, and also lab experiments using behavioral economics approaches. And then once we have the results of all of these, we'll enter the third phase. In my view, in a way, this is the most important phase, where we try to establish direct linkages between experts and the general public and policymakers through so-called mini fora or citizens' assemblies at small scale. The strategy here is to bring groups of ordinary lay people together with experts, place them in direct contact with each other, and to start conversations between them, and to try and see if this helps in establishing trust between the experts and the non-experts. I think this is the way to go to strengthen democracy in all sorts of areas. The steps have been taken quite successfully in Ireland when it came to the very difficult abortion referendum and the equal marriage referendum. And I think we can do the same for smaller but equally important questions of the role of science in our public life.
So what do you think it is about a citizens' assembly that makes it sort of so effective as a way of sort of overcoming problems in our existing system?
So democracy is supposed to take into account or be affected by the voice of the people. One of the issues that exists there, and I have to admit it, about the role of experts in policy decisions is that experts are not elected. They are not one of the people by definition. They know more about a particular subject matter than the general population. And yet they are to have a direct impact on our lives and on policy decisions that will affect our lives. So a citizen assembly in that particular instance, in the case of experts and policy decisions, would allow the voice of the people to be heard more directly. It will allow a dialogue between policymakers and the general public in a live and ongoing fashion. Citizens' assemblies are supposed to be based on conversations rather than a small group making decisions and then putting those decisions to vote. So it's a way of overcoming some of the deficits of a democratic system when that democratic system is being implemented in very large and technologically advanced societies in particular. It's a way of establishing a connection between people and the governance or the system of governance in place. That's why it can be applied to all sorts of issues, all sorts of questions, from small to large. And it has proven to be quite effective until such time that the more effective method is found.
What do you think would happen if we remove the public from the decision-making process?
Well, no, that would be exactly the wrong way to go. And that will give credence to the objections of the populist political leaders to relying on expertise. To have a plutocracy or a system where experts are governing even some a few aspects of our lives, let alone all aspects, would be a form of dictatorship, actually, even though it might be an enlightened form of dictatorship. But once you cut the voice of the general public, then you don't have a democracy anymore. And there's no reason to think that they will make the best judgments. They may be quite versed in their areas of expertise, but even experts themselves would admit that it's give and take, opposition, disagreement, putting your ideas to test. Those are the best ways of improving scientific expertise and also the best way of improving governance in general.
So what hope is there for the public's relationship with experts then?
So, interestingly, I think the horrendous events of the pandemic have improved so far the relationship between experts and the general public. Even Michael Gove, who famously questioned the role of experts and said, who needs experts, now relies on experts. Now, there are dangers to that. I think some governments, and we have seen examples of that in many different countries, do blame their errors on experts. Secondly, experts, in this case of pandemics, medical experts, virologists, etc., like all scientists, are prone to errors. The advice they give cannot be 100% correct, and their errors could have horrendous consequences. So they are placed in a particularly difficult position right now because there is so much uncertainty around this new virus. Any advice they might present is going to be inevitably provisional, but will have negative consequences once it's proven to be wrong. So we are witnessing a very interesting moment in the relationship between experts and the general public. On the one hand, the general public more than ever is showing trust in experts, and this has been backed by various surveys that have been taken around in European countries and in America on the question of COVID-19 and trust in experts. On the other hand, the position of the experts is incredibly precarious right now because they can be turned into scapegoats, and also they are inevitably going to give some incorrect advice or some overcautious advice, and then going to be blamed for their errors, and that can have long-term impact on the connection between experts and the lay people.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Philosophy for Our Times. Remember to like, subscribe, and review wherever you listen. And tune in next week for more big ideas from the world's leading thinkers.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.